Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the murder of Irina Zarudska continues to reverberate with questions about cat security being discussed.
I'm just trying to get to the visibility of cops on trains. Citizens are really confused.
That was part of a debate on Charlotte City Council this week, even as citizens gathered for a vigil in honor of Zarudska, and as the legislature has its own debate while passing Irina's law to overhaul bail and reestablish the death penalty. J.D. Vance comes to Concord, and he too enters the conversation on this topic, repeating something Donald Trump has said repeatedly about Blue City mayors.
We would love to have the mayor of Charlotte reach out for our help.
On the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Helene, Kristi Noem releases $48 million in federal recovery funds and a dust-up over comments made by the mayor of Monroe. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE senior editor Eli Portillo. Zach Turner is WFAE's climate reporter. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for being here. And by the way, Zach is our two-time champion for the week because he's been here before already this week. So, Zach, carry the ball.
Yep, we're proud of him.
That's right. On Monday, 1 month after her murder on a Blue Line train, Charlottesians gathered for a vigil at the East West station to honor Irina Zarudska. How did this commemoration come together, Eli?
Well, this was organized in part by the Mecklenburg GOP, folks who are hoping to highlight the crime, and some of them have talked about the what they say are Democrats' soft-on-crime policies. So there was a little of that political aspect, but there were also religious participants from multiple different churches, and there were people who knew Irina who were there, and there were people who didn't know her who drove, some of them from quite far. So it was on the 30-day anniversary and was organized as a celebration of this person's life and the tragedy of her death.
And hundreds of people evidently turned out. You mentioned friends of her, of hers turned out. Friends of the family also did, among them Yelena Stevenson, who was a friend of the family.
Well, I hope people come out, they speak out. I mean, this city needs some kind of a resolution and changes in the law. We cannot have criminals and put public in danger. Hopefully her death was not in vain and some changes will come.
And she also described how she would like that 23-year-old young woman to be remembered.
She was sweet, she was kind, she was affectionate, she loved her family, she loved the United States. I mean, that's all I could say. They were thrilled to be here. Running away from war, coming here was important for them to stay here, but she wanted a different life.
Her murder was heinous. It was caught on video. It has law and order implications, which we'll talk about. It also involves someone who has, as she just mentioned, fled her war-torn country, Ukraine, and came here with her family for a better life, which was cut all too short. Is that why this has gotten so much national attention, you think, Mary?
I think it's really a confluence of things. I think the fact that the video did go viral on social media, the fact that it was so jarring, I think the fact that this was such a young person, someone with such an impactful backstory, the fact that she was a refugee from a conflict that's very much sort of on the radar of the average person, and the fact that it happened in, you know, a place that so many of us have been, you know, a very popular neighborhood on a very common mode of transportation. It sort of, it creates that sense, I think, in the average Charlottean of that could have been me or somebody that I care about. So I think that makes it more likely to provoke that emotional response. And then also, obviously, the fact that so many political leaders at the local, state, and national level have sort of grabbed onto this case of, well, undoubtedly keeps it in the public eye and makes the conversations around it a lot more complicated than just the raw grief for the fact that a very young person lost their life.
And we will be talking about the political things that surround this as well this hour. The co-organizer of that memorial, Abdul Ali, saw this as a way to honor a young woman who came here for a better life.
We're here so that we don't forget what happened in our city. And we're here to honor the life of a young person who came to this country for the American dream that we've all heard about and we all want.
Ali is active in Mecklenburg County Republican Party politics. He ran unsuccessfully for Congress against Alma Adams in the 12th District in 2024. Did the event, Ryan, I don't know whether you were there or not, but did the event feel political, like a political opportunity? It was, or was it more of a solemn moment that was focused on the tragedy?
I was not there myself. I was covering city council at the same time. It should be noted it was held in the middle of a city council meeting. And organized by MEC GOP. Don't see a lot of these vigils that are organized by a political party in cooperation with West Boulevard Ministry, which is, the leader of that, Bart Noonan, is a huge open Trump supporter. I don't think, from what I've seen and all the reporting, it didn't feel like there were a lot of political speeches other than sort of, talking about the need for changes in laws and stuff. I don't think it turned into, a campaign stop for city council candidates by any means. It certainly, had a more political bent than most vigils you'd see or in community neighborhoods where they hold vigils for victims of violence on a regular basis.
And although there were a lot of religious leaders who were speakers, many of those religious leaders have run in the past for political office. One of them, Minister James Bowers, has run for Charlotte City Council. He said that people feel unsafe because of gangs and youth violence and a lack of being protected by police and leaders. He said, quote, "Today we are seeing the glory of the American standard being challenged through wrong ideologies and wrong thinking, which puts the hopes and dreams of our families and children into turmoil and chaos." Eli, did he explain what he meant by that? That seems a little convoluted.
Yep. Not that I saw. I will echo Ryan and say I didn't see a lot of overt political messaging in the event itself. In the videos that I saw, we had a reporter there, and it was mostly focused on her. I think we'll talk about the J.D. Vance visit, which right. had similar themes and I think was much more overtly and nakedly political and partisan.
What a surprise. Bart Noonan, executive director of the West Boulevard Ministry, said that the city is falling apart and the time to act was yesterday. That's a quote. I know that people of all levels of leadership are in deep discussions about this and have been for weeks. Will this turn out to be a turning point for Charlotte? Will we see effective changes in local policy, do you think, either on cats or policing or in other aspects of law enforcement and the legal system?
I do think that we'll see changes to CATS security. We've had reporters riding the light rail and recording observations and for a story next week, and everyone has reported fair enforcement and visible security, things that were not there before. Riders we've talked to have also seen that. As for whether this will be any sort of political turning point for the city, I think there's a less evidence of that. You look at who's running for mayor, the district races, the at-large races for council, and I mean, except for District 6, they're all set pretty much. Unless there's a massive surprise, there's not really competitive races. So I do think, just given the preponderance of Democratic voters in Charlotte and Democratic-leaning voters, we're not likely to see this as a sea change where there's, a Republican tough-on-crime surge at the local level.
Ryan.
And I will just note there's a lot of speaking. There was a lot of speeches at this public forum during the city council that was held at the same time as memorial, in which people sort of were implying that the city council needs to get on the district attorney to do this or do that. And I will remind you that the district attorney is an elected office. I'm not saying that Spencer Merriweather will necessarily be voted out because of this. I don't see that even necessarily happening, but it's just one of those things where what we deal with all the time, that folks aren't sure which department is run by which, or which agency is run by which body. And so the district people will have a chance to vote for district attorney. I'm actually now embarrassed as I'm saying this. I'm not sure when the next election is. I believe it's next year.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that is not necessarily under the purview of city council directing a district attorney.
Right. The debate over this and what needs to happen as a result of this is, has reached all levels of government, the local, state, federal, etc. And in Raleigh this week, the General Assembly passed Arena's Law, which was named after her. It was introduced by Mecklenburg Representative Republican Tricia Cotham.
This sweet and beautiful young woman was full of potential and a monster who already had 14 previous convictions, including and not limited to armed robbery, felony larceny, and the list goes on. A diagnosed schizophrenic. He was released by a magistrate without a secured bond, and the magistrate ignored all the very obvious red flags.
As we have discussed on this and other editions of this program many times, options for mental health treatment are sparse, the need for more prosecutors and enhanced court capacity is great, and it is dependent, all of that is dependent on state funding, and magistrates in our state have few qualifications, little oversight, and more power than similar officials in other states, something also evidently outlined by state law. So how much of the responsibility for this falls on the legislature? And that said, what does this new law do?
Well, I do think the legislature sets the ground rules and kind of bears a lot of the responsibility ultimately here. This new law aims to tighten up those bail standards. It would require, for example, magistrates and judges to do a written explanation for if they grant bail to someone who has certain prior convictions, certain numbers of felony charges, etc. The North Carolina Supreme Court Chief Justice would get the power to suspend magistrates who he thinks are doing a bad job. So that's another oversight mechanism. It also does away with cashless bail in some instances, and it requires mental health evaluations for people arrested for violent crimes with a past commitment or if a judge thinks they're a danger to themselves or others. The other big thing it does is it does add funding for 10 new Mecklenburg district attorneys, which are sorely needed. And it brings back some other execution methods to speed up the death penalty, which hasn't been carried out in North Carolina in almost two decades.
Democrats advocated for more training for these magistrates who make bail and incarceration decisions prior to trial. Republicans shot that request down, Mary, but the bill is said to put more oversight. Can you go into more detail about exactly who controls that oversight and how this changes for those magistrates?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure of the specifics for that. I will say with regard to the suspect in the Zarutska case, I really recommend people check out a story my colleague at The Observer, Julie Coyne, posted a couple weeks ago, looking at, you know, the guidelines that the magistrate in his previous arrest in January was following. And sort of outlining the options that that magistrate did have at that time, you know, based on what was what were the guidelines for magistrates at the time, rather than what's sort of theoretically being debated now for what magistrates will or won't have to do in the future.
Eli, we have 30 seconds.
I think one uncomfortable fact and consideration here is that there are a lot of people, probably thousands, who are arrested for low-level misdemeanors like this suspect had been and have mental health issues or prior arrests. The system needs more capacity to deal with those effectively.
I want to come back and talk about that. I want to talk about the new prosecutors that this bill allows Spencer Merriweather to hire and what that means, because prosecutors can only prosecute if the courts have room for them. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Eli Portillo and Zach Turner, both from WFAE News, Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, and Ryan Pitkin from Queen City Nerve. We're talking about Arena's Law, which was passed by the legislature and is awaiting the governor's signature or veto. This bill makes it more likely that people with mental health issues could be, quote, involuntarily committed to mental health facilities after being arrested for a crime. So two questions. Are there adequate facilities to house and treat these people if we start doing that? And two, how does this prevent them from committing crimes? I mean, does it provide for additional mental health treatment prior to being arrested for people who need it? And it's obvious that they need it. And in the case of the person who murdered Irina Zarudzka, his family had him committed, but he could only be committed for a week. And then they had to release him.
Yeah, that's been a huge issue. And one of the biggest complaints and objections that the Democrats who voted against this bill had was that it did not provide, you know, mental health funding and increased capacity for mental health treatment. Now, if you look at this particular
case, why not? If you want to fix the problem, why not address the problem?
Well, I think it depends on your definition of the problem. Republicans said that, you know, the problem is the bail system and people getting out too easily. They pointed to his history of involuntary commitment and previous violent arrests and said this is not someone who should be offered bail in the first place. So I think it depends on where you identify that problem. But if you look at his arrest, this particular one, remember it was misdemeanor misuse of the 911 system in January.
Right.
There, I mean, that's a very low level misdemeanor. That's the equivalent of basically prank calling 911. I think it's a really tough sell to say everyone who's arrested for that, who has any previous violent arrests, can be held indefinitely. I mean, there's just so many. And if you look to a previous series that WFAE did called Fractured, we actually spent a year looking at the mental health system in North Carolina for people who are charged with criminal offenses and found that it's just grossly inadequate. People are waiting for months or even years to get mental health services if they are judged, you know, unable to proceed in their criminal trials because of mental illness.
Republican lawmakers told Democrats that they were trying not to spend any money aside from the amount of money they set aside for the 10 prosecutors, the 10 new prosecutors that this law will allow for. Mecklenburg DA Spencer Merriweather has cried out for years now for more prosecutors because of our exploding growth as a city. And he's also pointed to case backlogs in the court and several judges who have appeared on this program and have been interviewed by other news outlets say we need a lot more there as well. More prosecutors bringing cases that the courts cannot handle and that sit on the docket for years is not helpful. Is that remedied by this bill, Mary?
Yeah, so as Eli mentioned, there is funding in the bill for more staffing at the Mecklenburg District Attorney's Office. That's something that, you know, has been talked about for a long time. More state money for that kind of system is something that comes up frequently. For example, when Mecklenburg County Commissioners are talking about their budget for the year and the pleas that they're hearing to get more money into the system. So we could see some potential benefits there.
Maybe I tuned out. I'm sorry. Forgive me. But I'm trying to figure out, yes, he got more prosecutors, but is there more court capacity? Is that in the bill? That's my question. Maybe you answered it and I just didn't hear it.
I'm not sure if there's anything specifically related to court capacity. I don't know if anybody else wants to jump in and has clarity on that.
Yeah, nothing that I saw in this bill specifically relates to that. I will say Spencer Merriweather, the district attorney in Mecklenburg County, has pointed out that over, I believe, the past decade, while the population here has continued to boom, his office has only been able to add one prosecutor.
Yeah. Okay. The death penalty is, let me talk about this first. The bill passed through the Senate first, then it passed the House. But in the Senate, the vote was only 28-8 because Democrats walked out and the remaining Democrats who stayed behind voted no. Why did they walk out? Why did they vote no?
Well, that was a due to a last minute amendment that was added by, I believe it was Senate Leader Phil Berger. And that was to sort of get the North Carolina death penalty back in action, if you will. The death penalty has been legal in North Carolina. It's never been illegalized, but it has been sort of halted to a stop. And the excuse used is that, you know, there's questions about certain uses and things like that, and the appeals process takes this long and that long. So what they've done is try to shore that up by introducing new uses like the firing squad. Welcome back to, you know, that sounds like we're going back to mid 20th century, if not further. It's also sped up the appeals process, said that you have to appeal in your own county as opposed to everyone appealing in Wake and bottlenecking there. So that's sort of the effort to sort of stick a death penalty clause amendment into this law. And that's where Democrats were like, hold on, this is not anything to do with what happened here that we're trying to respond to, this murder.
So debate over the particulars of this legislation was described as emotionally and politically charged in Raleigh. Republicans saying Democrats are soft on crime, Democrats accusing Republicans of being unserious about solutions and unwilling to pay for the mental health and law enforcement services needed to fix the problems. Republican State Senator Danny Britt of Robeson County was in favor of the bill, but he still admitted its weaknesses.
We believe this does make North Carolina safer and does help to promote law and order in the state of North Carolina, but we do have more work to do on involuntary commitments and mental health in the space of the criminal justice system.
Durham County Representative Marsha Morey opposed the bill because of the execution methods and took exception to how Republicans like Donald Trump described the suspect in the Zarutska murder.
Our president calls this person an animal. Boy, do our Christian values go down the tube within an instant.
But Republican House Majority Leader Brendan Jones of Columbus County has no sympathy for the killer.
Where was his kindness? Where was his mercy? Ending a life for no reason. Ridiculous comments.
To be clear, the accused murderer, we've said this already, the accused murderer, DeCarlos Brown, is alleged to be schizophrenic. If that proves to be true, does this new law make any concessions for that or increase the availability of treatment to a sufficient degree that might have prevented him from getting on that train and doing what he did?
You know, I don't think that it increases treatment options for folks in that particular crisis situation or at all. That was, again, really Representative Morey's main objection. One thing I wanted to highlight is I think you're seeing obviously a lot of politics swirl around this case. And for some Democrats, it puts them in a tricky spot because while acknowledging the humanity and the illness of the killer, alleged killer, is a nuanced and thoughtful position, it's probably not the more politically popular one. And a lot of people don't want to hear nuance and thoughtful discussion of mental illness. They want to hear, this guy's a monster, we're going to get tough on him. Right. And Republicans certainly see an opening there and I think have the potential to grab a politically compelling message.
And I should have said doing what he allegedly did, because even though it's on video, he's not been convicted of anything yet. So does this bill does expand death penalty options. We had stopped using the death penalty. We put it on pause for many of the reasons that Ryan mentioned. Also the fact that there was some discussion years ago about how inhumane that might be, because it doesn't always take effect very quickly. And some of the manufacturers of the pharmaceuticals used to make that happen were withholding the drug, so you couldn't do it that way. But this new bill evidently, what, restores choice? You can do it with a lethal injection, you can do it with hanging, you can do it with a firing squad, you can do it with an electric chair. Is that all correct?
I believe there's also gas now back in blood.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
If it's being used in another state. So those are methods that are being used in some other states.
So
and that's something that, you know, as Mike, you said, you know, there were a lot of questions and legal challenges that came up. And I think the 2010 surrounding lethal injection drugs, So this is something we've seen in other Republican-led states. South Carolina, for example, has increased its number of executions in recent years, in part by bringing back the firing squad. So not necessarily a new tactic there, but something that's sort of getting tacked on to this legislation.
So when he was Attorney General, now Governor Josh Stein, supported the death penalty and argued many appeals on behalf of the state to keep convicted killers on death row. Given the opposition to this bill by Democrats in the legislature, is he likely to sign or veto this?
I think he's likely to sign it based on it having a veto-proof majority, at least in the House, which is where it really matters. He said he is considering it. I would be very surprised if he does not sign it.
And the debate over a solution to make us all safer also centers, at least in Charlotte, around cats. This week, Charlotte City Council approved plans for a private security firm to patrol around transit system facilities. We've already had this private security firm in place, at least on some of the vehicles. We have CMPD. Why do we need these additional personnel, these private personnel, for which we are paying more money? We're paying CMPD, and now we're paying more money. Why do we need all this?
Go ahead.
City Council will tell you that, you know, CMPD is already in a massive shortage and been battling with that for many years and trying to recruit more officers. And this is just sort of their way of saying, you know, we've got this over here as far as CATS properties goes. CMPD doesn't technically have jurisdiction there, but they're allowed to come help if PSS calls them. PPS, sorry. So it's just now PPS also has a staff shortage. So yes. They're just sort of working together and patching together what they can to try to shore up security, I suppose.
PPS is Professional Police Services. Will these people, do these people have arrest powers? Do they carry weapons?
So under the mutual agreement with the city, they have policing powers, you know, to arrest people, cite people, detain people. I believe they're armed. They have their they go through the same basic law enforcement training curriculum, but those powers are limited geographically to the transit system and areas adjacent. And what this expansion did was expand the geographic area where those private police powers can be enacted.
City Councilman Edwin Peacock made a point of expressing to council that people need to feel safe on public transit and that cops need to be seen.
I'm just trying to get to the visibility of cops on trains. This is part where I think the citizens are really confused. We have individuals that are riding these trains right now that people do not know why they're there. They don't feel safe.
So when he speaks of individuals riding the trains that people don't know why they're there and therefore they don't feel safe, is he speaking about security people or is he speaking strictly about transit riders?
I believe in the full context of that, he was speaking about people who are homeless or who are maybe intoxicated, combative, harassing people. He's spoken a lot about how people are intimidated by a small number of transit riders, which is something we heard from some riders we've interviewed too, actually.
Which is why he's advocating for law enforcement to be seen so that people feel that they have somebody has their back. CATS interim CEO Brett Cagle says the added presence of law enforcement should reassure riders. But earlier this month at a meeting of the Metropolitan Transit Commission, he said, quote, "You may not see them, but they are watching over you as a rider, and all riders have the ability to request help through our app or 911. Mary, what has been the reaction to that? That doesn't give me a lot of confidence. If I can't see them, I don't know that they're there.
Yeah.
Who has time for an app?
This is something that CATS has talked about a lot with regard to both security as well as fair enforcement. This idea that in a city this big, with a system this large, it is not necessarily feasible to have a fair enforcement person and a security person on every train 24/7, 365, but that if you saturate the system enough, it will sort of encourage good behavior by riders. It will encourage people to follow the rules to buy a ticket. And also that it will reassure people, while also, like you said, emphasizing the fact that there are security cameras the ability to call security. But at the same time, like you said, you know, in an emergency situation.
But this is all reactive. This is not proactive. This would not prevent anything. It is reactive to what has happened or what is about to happen or what is likely to happen. Fellow Republican Councilman Ed Driggs has said that the city must consider being more aggressive in dealing with passengers who may not be breaking the law, but who are making passengers uncomfortable. I mean, that comes with all kinds of constitutional right violation potential, it seems to me. And as one of you pointed out, Brett Cagle, the interim CAT CEO, says it's simply not feasible to put law enforcement on every single bus and every single train car.
Yeah, one thing, 2 points on that. One is that increased fare enforcement is a big part of this. And Katz has said that DeCarlos Brown, the suspect in this case, did not have a ticket. So I think some of the thinking is if you start enforcing fares, you're going to get a lot of the people who are just kind of cruising back and forth and maybe prevent them from doing something bad on transit. The other is that we've talked to our reporter, Steve Harrison, has spent a lot of time this week interviewing transit riders. And for example, he spoke with a woman who rides daily to and from NODA, and she said that she is frequently sexually harassed and often has derogatory comments. And I think that kind of behavior is an example of something that's not breaking the law. But if there is a security guard there who could say, hey, stop that.
Or get off the train.
Yeah. So that's some of what they're talking about there.
There are local, state, and federal agencies all investigating security protocols at CATS. And Council's Edwin Peacock says the city has to keep citizens up to date on this.
We've got, obviously, Department of Transportation, FTA, State of North Carolina. It's just, it just keeps coming, guys. And I'm waiting to hear, like, give me some confidence that this is going to change.
Now, perhaps the information flow needs to begin with giving information to people on council. Council member Renee Johnson is upset because the city has not released numbers on how many crimes have been committed on the transit system, which she says should have been released long ago. Mary, you're the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Is this part of what appears to be a long-standing problem of council members being kept informed or being kept uninformed by city staff?
It's hard to ignore that this is a complaint that we hear from our elected officials a lot when we have these big things. When they were voting on whether or not to give $650 million to David Tepper, they said they wish they'd had more information earlier so that it wasn't such a short notice decision. When they were talking about giving a six-figure settlement to our outgoing police chief, some talked about how they felt like they needed more information and that some people were hearing things others weren't. So it's hard to ignore the fact that this is something we hear repeatedly whenever we've got these big headline-making issues coming before council.
Meanwhile, State Supreme Court Chief Justice Paul Newby has launched a pretrial release task force in the wake of the Irina Zaritska murder. He says the group will make recommendations no later than 1 year from now. When we come back, J.D. Vance was in Concord this week. We'll talk about that and no state budget and more.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins, Eli Portillo, and Zach Turner with us from our WFAE newsroom. Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, Ryan Pitkin from Queen City Nerve. Vice President J.D. Vance came to Concord this week with this murder on the Blue Line train on his mind.
If the mayor of Charlotte and the governor of North Carolina asked for our help, we would absolutely send it because we believe in helping people, regardless of whether they're Democrats or Republicans. We would love to have the mayor of Charlotte reach out for our help.
That came up in the context of his characterizing North Carolina Democrats' approach to public safety as soft and calling on Governor Stein to sign a new crime bill that we've been talking about this hour. He came to stress the Trump administration's commitment to empowering state and local law enforcement and to talk about tax policy. But he also reiterated his long-held thoughts that this country is too soft on crime.
I think that if a person is being violent and threatening to young children and young families, they ought to send their asses to prison instead of telling people that they got to cross the other side of the street.
So clearly he got a big reaction to that, and he certainly isn't wrong. Does this new crime bill, however, Ryan, address that?
I think it does to a certain extent, just in the sense of their wanting to end cashless bail has been a long time goal. But, you know, there's a lot of hyperbole there, and, you know, he's using a lot of untrue statements during that speech, not necessarily part of that clip. But
one of those untrue statements dealt with the crime rates here as compared to third world countries. He says if you go to Port-au-Prince, Haiti — this is in the Observer this morning — if you go to Port-au-Prince, Haiti, you go to some of the poorest countries all over the world, even those countries have a better murder rate than Washington, D.C. or some of the major American cities. Some of them, he says, have better murder rates than Charlotte. That's a disgrace. That's a quote. But that's not true. The numbers are wrong, as are so many of the numbers that come out of this administration, Mary.
Yeah, my colleague Nora O'Neill at The Observer dug into the stats a bit. The two specific cities in the developing world that the vice president mentioned were Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and Mogadishu, Somalia. Port-au-Prince has a very high murder rate, according to reputable sources. We found significantly higher than Charlotte's murder rate and the murder rate in comparably sized U.S. cities. Data from Mogadishu is much more limited, but worth noting the State Department has a lot of warnings instituted for Americans not to go there because of heightened safety risks.
Is there a racial aspect to comparing Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and parts of Africa to blue-controlled cities? Is there a racial aspect to those accusations?
I think so. I think that's one of the big things we didn't mention earlier when we said about why this crime was able to go so national and viral. And it's unfortunate, but it can't be dismissed. The fact that it was a white woman and a black man attacking her is sort of what led to some of the darker corners of the internet really getting a hold of it and being able to play up those angles. And you see that played out in some of these speeches.
So Vance also used his Concord whistle stop as an opportunity to stress his low tolerance for violence against law enforcement.
You don't have to agree with my immigration policies. You don't have to agree with Donald Trump's immigration policies. But if your political rhetoric encourages violence against our law enforcement, you can go straight to hell and you have no place in the political conversation of the United States of America.
Does the date January 6th mean anything to these people? Was he specifically referring to how some people, not many, have reacted to the masked, unbadged, unidentified people grabbing people off the streets and putting them into unmarked vehicles? Or is he referring to something else?
You know, I'm not sure in that specific context. I do know that has been a frequent theme with them calling out folks like Gavin Newsom, who's criticized masked agents. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about that. And we've seen this idea that if you criticize tactics or laws or moves by the administration, you are doing something un-American and must be punished or stopped from it.
Yes, well, the opposite is true. Okay, Zach, you're on. North Carolina Senator Ted Budd took an unusual... We have to calm things down here. We have to bring the climate reporter in. Nothing political about climate. North Carolina Senator Ted Budd took an unusual step this week. He voted against a procedure allowing the Senate to move forward with voting on a Trump nominee in an effort to get the administration's attention for the need of Hurricane Helene relief money to parts of North Carolina. He wants them to stop delaying those funds. It worked. What happened?
Yeah, so this was North Carolina Senator Ted Budd kind of breaking a little bit with his party to step into this somewhat kind of procedural nomination going on in the Senate, just to get in the way of Trump's nomination of Robert Law in the Department of Homeland Security's Undersecretary for Strategy, Policy, and Plans. And he said that this is, you know, not about Robert Law. He thinks he's a fine guy, but this is more about drawing attention to this issue of needing to accelerate relief and aid for Western North Carolina coming from FEMA. And he was able to get, I guess, a minor concession from Kristi Noem in the form of an additional $12 million being approved and reimbursements for North Carolina.
She set up, when she became Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, and she oversees FEMA, she set up this new procedure shortly after taking office in which she has to personally review any expenditure by FEMA in excess of $100,000. And critics have said that has slowed down the process, and it probably has. But in addition to this $12 million there's this, that you just referred to, there's a $48 million, which has been delayed, has now been approved, and will fund 31 newly approved projects and 18 other large projects in Western North Carolina. Where's this money going, and when is it due to arrive?
Yeah, I can speak a little bit to where it's going. I saw that some of it was going to places like Appalachian State University, Buncombe County. This is going to, you know, universities, local governments to fund some specific projects, and then some like kind of broader categories of like architecture and engineering projects that need to be done. What's difficult about this is like tracking where all of these funds are going. And then you can still go to places like when I was in Black Mountain earlier this week and talking to the fire chief there, they haven't received any federal money yet, despite having, I believe, $27 million in projects that they still need to have reimbursed. So this money is not necessarily reaching all of the small towns in Western North Carolina. And there are still many that are waiting to get reimbursed.
Meanwhile, the governor has launched a $50 million grant program for Helene recovery. This is separate from the FEMA money. So what is that now? $98 million that has been released to Western North Carolina. What is that money, the $50 million earmarked for?
So this is going to be open to... this is going to be open to local governments, and this is going to go to federally recognized tribes for these capital projects in FEMA-designated disaster areas where they have been kind of rejected. Their application for FEMA reimbursements have been not approved. So this is an alternative for them to still get some money from the federal government.
And although it doesn't seem like it's related to the environment, data centers are, Zach. The world runs on data, and that data is stored, and it flows through data centers around the world. But increasingly, the location of those data centers has become a bone of contention by those in communities where they want to locate them or operate them. And now residents in Matthews have voiced concerns about a proposed data center at I-485 and East John Street. Why?
So they say that this is going to be, they're worried about noise pollution and sort of a lack of actual benefits to the community here. We're talking about a rather large project on 123 acres out by Matthews. And for this kind of size of project, it's actually bringing relatively few jobs. This is going to bring about 100 new jobs. And you can look at other projects like some clean energy projects, like the $14 million Toyota investment in Liberty, North Carolina, that was bringing thousands of jobs for this type of project. So I think residents are concerned that it's going to be a large impact for their community while bringing relatively little benefits to the actual folks that live there.
And this is not over yet. The Matthews Town Board has decided to hold another public hearing on this on October the 13th. The legislature has yet to pass a budget, and cuts to Medicaid as a result are looming large. They will, I think, likely be cut on, what, October the 1st, which is days away. And state teachers and other employees who have been waiting on pay raises promised to them are continuing to go without those raises. Why is there a lack of urgency, Eli, over passing this budget?
Well, the legislature was back this week, as we've mentioned, and they got in and out without reaching a budget agreement. Just a reminder, the fiscal year starts July 1st. So when you have no budget like we have now, it's not like the state shuts down like the federal government might soon. Prior year spending levels just continue. So I think there's some lack of urgency because the government doesn't shut down. I mean, if universities and schools shut down, it would be a different story. But Josh Stein, I keep wanting to say Roy Cooper, it's only been a year. Governor Stein is trying to inject a sense of urgency by continually talking about the Medicaid cuts that will come without supplemental funding. So he's saying, hey, let's get on it, let's get on it. And the Republican leaders, Berger and Hall, in the Senate and House, they still have disagreements about fiscal issues, and they're basically, neither one of them is willing to budge.
Yeah. This is going to happen to Medicaid recipients October the 1st. Do we know how many people are going to be affected by this should this budget not be complete and signed, et cetera?
So I am not an expert in this, but my understanding is that reimbursement rates will be cut. So as opposed to people, you know, being thrown off the rolls, for lack of a better term, this would be cuts to rates that providers receive, which would hurt providers. Rural hospitals especially have long been struggling and have a higher number of Medicaid recipients, a higher proportion of them. It would also potentially influence, you know, whether doctors, providers are even willing to engage with Medicaid, or if they'd say, you know, like, this is a big hassle and we're getting lower provider rates, so we're not going to take these patients.
This week, the Union County NAACP called on the Monroe City Council to remove Mayor Robert Burns from office. They say he weaponized his social media accounts to target private citizens. How so, Ryan? Turn your mic on.
Apologies. So there's a member of the Union County Democratic Party. He's now part of, he's now the executive committee member. He was the former chair, and he had posted a post, Perrin Baxter. He's posted on Facebook a very long sort of, I don't want to call it a manifesto, but a very long post stating sort of where we are in the world following Charlie Kirk's death, saying that fascists need to see that we will dance on their graves, things like that. It's doing the work of white supremacy to grieve Kirk over Black people or Palestinians who are killed. And Robert Burns, mayor of Monroe, sort of took to social media to make his own post calling for him to be removed from the Democratic Party. He started tagging other folks like libs of TikTok, who he knew would sort of drudge up and their followers and send them after this guy. And it's not the first time Burns has been accused of doing this. He was censured and...
To be clear about this, Burns, Mayor Burns, reposted a post by Democratic executive, former, is he former or is he current Democratic executive board member Perrin Baxter from Union County?
He's current member, former chair.
Okay, Mr. Baxter made the comment about we must mock authoritarians, fascists, wannabe dictators. We must mock them and dance on their graves. That's a quote. And Burns reposted that. That doesn't sit well with the NAACP. And here's the organization's Union County president, Archie Hansley.
The consequences of Mayor Burns' actions have already been felt. Local organizations, as well as private citizens, have actually received death threats. Staffs have been sent home for safety concerns, and families now fear for their well-being.
Help me to understand this. He reposted something that somebody else posted and he's getting the heat?
Right. I think it was more of the fact that he's trying to tag in all these accounts that are known for sending their followers after folks in a national sort of targeting campaign, like libs of TikTok specifically. I think that was where the problem was over... I don't know, maybe being expected to repost and say, look at what we're dealing with on the other political party himself. And that's where they took issue, as well as there's been issues with him in 2024. He was subject to a vote of no confidence because he used the town's sort of accounts to voice his own political opinions. He's had a history of sort of belligerence on social media.
We need to shut down social media.
That might be the answer.
Let's do it.
As we spoke about a minute ago, data hubs may be controversial, but innovation hubs are welcome. And this week, Charlotte-based Honeywell is announced they are investing $10 million in a new hub to boost STEM education at UNC Charlotte. Eric Seidel is Senior Vice President at Honeywell.
So you now have the opportunity to have a truly immersive environment here where you can learn on the state-of-the-art and the sophisticated programs and automation that we have in. So again, I think that's a huge, huge competitive advantage for the university.
There will also be additional faculty because of this and scholarships, and they also believe that once this opens, this hub opens in 2027, it will be an asset to the region, a new pipeline for local tech talent. And in talking about this, UNC Charlotte Chancellor Sharon Gaber said, "This is a great city, and so we are the city's great university, and we continue to push that to make sure that the city recognizes that." Well, the great university aspect of UNC Charlotte has been recognized by U.S. News and World Report. They moved up 9 spots overall rankings, in overall rankings, to 143, and up 7 spots for public universities to 74. Do U.S. News and World Report rankings do anything for a school? Eli, we have 10 seconds.
Well, you know, I think it's better to go up than down.
And we'll leave it at that. Oh, speaking of going down, Charlotte FC did not break their record of hoping to have 9 consecutive wins. They lost to New York last week. But surprise upon surprise, the Panthers won last weekend. Blowout against Atlanta, 30-0. This week they play a team with an identical record, but that team, the Patriots, are favored to win. Eli Portillo, Zach Turner from WFAE, Mary Ramsey from The Observer, Ryan Pitkin from Queen City NERV.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.